This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, 100 years and the band plays on. We'll hear about the history of the Donkin Citizens Brass Band. Some advice for businesswomen in Cape Breton as a Halifax University opens a new center in Sydney. And executed by the SS, the tragic story of four Cape Bretoners killed in the D-Day invasion 75 years ago. All of that coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. The Donkin Citizens Brass Band is blowing its own horn these days as band members celebrate the 100th anniversary of the band. Ken Reed is bandmaster and conductor of the Donkin Band.
22nd of July, 1919, there were five members of the community in about their 30s standing on the corner in the evening, I guess, on the corner of West Street and South Street in Donkin. That'd be right across where the new post office is now. And they were discussing music. One was a former counselor, I guess two were former counselors and or counselor, and those were involved in union activities, on the executive, treasurer, secretaries. And they just thought they got it going, and they said, let's organize a band for the village. And it went from there.
Did everybody know how to play instrument at that time?
That's the thing, where I'm looking at the names of the original members. And the war was just over. First World War was over 1918. Mm-hmm. They're back home. They're in the collieries, and a few of the members that were in the band were in the 185th Battalion Band that was stationed out in Broughton before they shipped overseas, the Highlanders. And when they got over to England, they became the 85th Nova Scotia Highlanders, and they were in bands. And I think their job was they'd be stretcher bearers in the battalions. And support staff in the trenches.
So these were people that already, they were playing music already.
They were playing music already.
But there was no such, was it the first type of its band in this area to be formed?
In our area it was. There were bands in Glace Bay. It was a Passchendaele band. There was a band up in LOL bands in Glace Bay. And New Aberdeen and Passchendaele had a band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this was a brass band.
We were a brass band.
What did they do back then? Where did they play? The history of their, did they just go out in the community and play wherever they wanted to, or?
Yeah, when they organized and they got her going, their first appearance was in Christmas Day of 1919 down at what we call the Schooner Pond Dam. That was our water supply till just a number of years ago.
Yeah.
And they marched out on that in the frozen pond and I guess playing when the instruments came in, and they played a few tunes, and I guess they froze up The instruments froze up, and they left, but the start was made. That's what, according to the book.
What would they have been playing? What kind of music did they play today?
They would have waltzes, marches, and I guess the basic music of the popular music of the day, what they could get in print. Yeah.
And then just practice.
And practice wherever they could go. That was an issue too, finding a place to practice while they're in Donkin. They had no permanent home at that time.
Yeah.
And they went they went first to the fireman's parlor in Donkin. Now, apparently, the fireman's parlor in 1919 was run by the coal company. They had the fire department, and there's pictures showing them in fireman garb, raincoats and slickers with Sal Westers on, in front of the bank head of the old number 6 mine. So connecting the dots there, they were coal company employees. So we got the band at that time used their little hall, I guess, what equipment they had in it. But it was small, apparently. And then they got room to use a room in the school, the original school in Donkin, which is still there on McLean Street. It's a complex now of apartments.
And they would practice there?
Yep.
Is that what
they had a school room, and then that was not becoming available. So then they went to the coal company. It was Besco, British Empire Steel Coal Company, And they asked if they could have, they give their reasons about being isolated over Weir over there in Donkin, and entertainment, and they give the whole, you know, the whole resume of why they should have a building.
Yeah.
And the company agreed with them.
They sold them on it.
They sold them on it. And the coal company, and apparently the name in their history book, Roy Wolven. Roy Wolven, the famous Roy Wolven of the 25 strike, who was the president of the company at that time, was not very well liked. And he agreed, and they got a piece of land, and they built it for the inside and out, completely finished, inside and out. And that's where the band stayed up until 3 years ago.
It's a great story.
Yeah. And the building was, it was a room, literally a room. It was 25 by 25 by 11 high. It was designed as a band room. And like I should say, our band is designed on the British brass band theme. All collieries over there, even what's left over there in name, had a band. And most major manufacturing firms had bands. And they're just like we have hockey teams and soccer teams and football and sports teams and how you compete for the main prize, the Grey Cup, Stanley Cup.
Yeah. There was competition
there.
There
was competitions, and the best major filtered up through to the winners and went to the Royal Albert Hall in England. So that's how serious it was over there, and still is to a point today.
So that was 100 years ago. So how does a band keep playing, no pun intended, for 100 years? You're in the band, right? How long have you been in it?
Well over 50 years.
So what does it have? What does that organization have, or what has it had over the years to make people keep coming back and to keep it as strong as it is?
We always talk about that. It's just the comradeship and the love of music. When you sit down in your chair and you start playing the music, you just come together, everything leaves you. You've got no other worries in the world. When you come into the hall, we've often discussed that kind of theme. But, and there's a comradeship too with it. There's bandsmen, there's musicians, and there's bands people. I should say in this day and age, bands people.
What's the difference?
Well, to me, you can be both, or you can be separate. A musician is a person who's accomplished on some whatever instrument he has, either brass, woodwind, or their voice. A band's person is a musician of different levels of ability, but they're within the group and they support each other. They support each other. If you ask this band's person to go on a different instrument to support the group or help out, it's just in the heart, you know. It's part of you, and
you don't go anywhere for 50 years because you don't like going there.
Exactly, yeah.
So you still enjoy it to this very day.
Oh yeah, oh yes I do.
How many people are in?
Well, right now we're down to we're down to 14 members. We should have 27.
That would be perfect, 27.
That would, for brass band, that would be ideal. 30 would be ideal.
And how active is the band today? Is it still?
Well, we do a lot of volunteer work. We go to the seniors' homes. We never miss Remembrance Day since in Donkin, since it was incepted after the First World War.
Right.
Never missed a parade.
Amazing.
No. Firemen's light up in Donkin. We had a cadet corps over there, and we played for their annual inspection every year.
I can recall as a youth skating at the Glace Bay Miners Forum to the Donkin Citizens Brass Band.
Yeah,
is that recollection correct for me? Was it?
Oh, yes.
Would it have been the Donkin Band?
Yes, it was. Yeah, we didn't do skating when I first joined. It was kind of gone onto off to the side. I didn't do it anymore. But the music was all there, and then in 1967, the centennial year, they built the Centennial Arena in Sydney, and I can't remember the manager's name, but he was great to us. He, when they got that place going, Centennial Arena, he called us in, and when we played for skating there, and we stayed there, I think, for about 5 years. We used to put before the plexiglass was up on along the sides of these arenas.
Yeah.
There was nothing, just behind the goaltenders' nets. And when those skaters would go around, we had to put clothespins on the music. It would blow it right off the stand. there was that many on for the skating, and we'd done that for 5 years, and we were there for one year, I think, for 22 weeks. When skating was over, they took the ice out and they called us back for roller skating.
Wow.
And it turned us around financially for a while. It gave us a great we could get work done on the hall, the old hall that was there by that, you know, and then get it fixed up. And
so who can belong to the band? Do you have to be a resident of the area, or can you come from outside?
Yeah. Well, that would be, you know, anybody can join. Just come in and have a knowledge of a brass band instrument. Like, well, we don't have clarinets or saxophones or the woodwinds, flutes. We don't. That's not the makeup of our organization. A brass band is based on a cornet section, and ideally there should be 9 cornets. It's a smaller version of a trumpet, more a mellower instrument. Yeah. Rather than French horns, we use alto horns, pitched in E flat, and 3 would be ideal. We have a bass section, of course, tubas, and a brass band, there's 2 E-flat basses pitched in E-flat and 2 B-flat pitched tubas. And that's just the sound that they make, you know, in connection is, and then percussion, of course, and then that can go forever, percussion, depending on the knowledge and the expertise you have of who you have
is,
on, the,
is
on
it,
the drums.
Is it loud? Does a brass band make a lot of...
We can be.
Yeah, a lot of noise.
We can be. No, it's if you listen to, you can get up on YouTube and you can hear some of the best brass bands in the world, you know. Grimthorpe Colliery Band, FSW Band, these English bands. Just go up YouTube and go brass bands. And
you'll see the best in the world.
You'll see the best in the world.
So where do you, okay, coming up, you've got your 100th anniversary, and I imagine you've got a lot of things planned, have you?
Well, the membership that we have and the age of the membership we have, to be honest and truthful, we settled on three days. We couldn't go like just week celebrations. We don't have the membership to make the chair of the committees and whatever.
Right.
So, but we decided on three days, and well, Friday night is going to be like a meet and greet. We'll get the instruments, we'll put the stands together, and just have a little jam session with the whoever be former members if they're there, and you know, and enjoy that. And then we'll fold them up. We'll have a meet and greet. Saturday we're going to have a banquet, of course, in Donkin, and then Sunday evening we're going to have a memorial service in Donkin.
What are the dates?
July 12th to the 14th, 12th, 13th, and 14th.
What are the duties of the conductor? What do you do to keep things moving?
Well, just keep them in order. I direct them. I start them, stop them, and I select the music. What we can play and we can make credible sound with, you know, with what we have.
Yeah.
And when we start up in the fall of every year, I stand up in front of the band and I say, okay, you've had the summer off. Now, what would you like us, what certain music or piece of music would you like to see us perform? If we can handle it, I says, out she comes.
Yeah. And did you, Ken, have a musical background before you got involved with the band?
Well, I started when I was 12 years old in the band, and then up until about 18, I guess, and I got signed into the Armed Forces, and I was heading for the Navy. And I on the application form in Sydney, Victoria Park, I put on the application form, it said hobbies. Well, one of the hobbies I put was music. Now, that's just one little word. And they were opening the Armed Forces School of Music after that. And I get into that. In addition, I get into the Armed Forces School of Music. So with that background, basic directing and whatever.
Yeah.
And things didn't work out for me as I planned with the career options, and I just didn't see it as the life I wanted to have. So when I had my chance, I got out. And I got out in 72. And...
But the music stayed with you.
Oh yes, yeah. Oh yes. And as soon as I got back home, right back to rehearsal, found out what instrument was available, and I got back into her.
It really is a remarkable story that that band would still be around 100 years later after you say being formed just by a couple of people talking on a street corner, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
It has to be a testament to the people who are part of the band that it's still going as well, right?
You just show up, It's you shake your head at it. Like you show up the night of rehearsal, and you show up the next week for rehearsal, just 1 week after the other. If you don't show up, she's gone.
Has there ever been a week when you said, "Look, I don't want to go"?
Never. 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 I walked away from a few bad notes. I walked away from situations that we had no control over, you know, weather or, you know.
I was going to ask you, is a lot of the performances done inside or outside?
We've done them all. We've done inside, a lot of outside, you know, parades.
Yeah.
That was our main bread and butter one time. We're self-sponsored. We're always self-sponsored. We've never had a...
No major sponsor.
No major sponsors, whatever. Well,
that way you don't have to tie down to anybody.
Well, it's all you have. They bought their own instruments.
Really?
Yep. Not out of pocket. They bought them as a group. Yeah. That self is a story in itself. That was the formation of the first instruments.
That you bought paid for your own.
They sat down. They stood in that street corner. You can see them. You can see them there with pipes and chewing tobacco on that corner.
Yeah.
And they. I can just imagine them right there, and then they decided, let's have a band. And they went to Wally and Royce in Ontario, Toronto, and they ordered 17 instruments. We have one left in their possession, the trombone.
The original one.
The original one.
Wow.
They're around, I guess, but Lord knows. But they paid $1,000. It cost them $1,000.
A lot of money back then.
Four of those organizers, I'm looking, one is my great-grandfather, and the other one was my grandfather. And they had families, and the rest of them had large families. And four of the organizers put up $100 each in 1919 when wages were $1.50 a day.
It was a significant amount of money.
There was a man in Duncan, Duncan McVicker, who became the first president of the band. He put up the other $600. 1919. We've never questioned where he had or how we raised it. What kind of. But anyway, he put that up for the band, and I guess he was paid back, of course, that's naturally. And that's how they got, and they went around, and I figure, like, when the First World War was over and these guys returned, that were bandsmen or were Scottish or Welsh or English, northern English miners that came come over here to mine the coal from England, come over here, that they had band experience, and they were given an instrument.
Ken, thanks for chatting with us about it. It's extremely interesting. The big celebration's coming up again in July.
Yep, 12, 13th and 14th.
13th and 14th.
Friday night will be at the Royal Canadian Legion Branch 5. Saturday will be at our banquet will be at the Fire Hall in Duncan. And our memorial service will be held in St. Luke's United Church in Duncan, 7 o'clock.
More people, the merrier.
Yes, that'd be great to see them come out and remember the band.
Ken Reed, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dave. This is great, boy. I appreciate it so much.
The Center for Women in Business, based at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax, has opened an office in Cape Breton. The center will offer advice to business women on the island and coordinate and deliver skills development training programs. Dialogue spoke with Port Hood native Courtney Schmidt, who will serve as the center's new business advisor for the Cape Breton region.
So the Center for Women in Business has dedicated to female entrepreneurs for 27 years, and they've been working with over 15,000 women. The center supports and serves business owners in Nova Scotia and also Atlantic Canada, and they help to close the gender gap in the business sector. So this program is a two-year pilot. They've been working on this for several years to bring the center to Cape Breton. And it's based on the needs of women in Cape Breton that were looking for additional services. And although the center provided services via Skype calls and online training, they found the real value is in meeting face-to-face.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about the gender gap that you referenced. I know, you know, some people might be listening and they might not be, especially men, might not be aware of the gender gap or other barriers underlying that face women in business. Could you talk a bit about that?
Mm-hmm. So in Canada, 99% of the Canadian businesses here are small and medium sized. But only about less than 16% are actually even majority owned by women or just owned by women. but also like pitches, for example. The pitches that are made by male entrepreneurs are funded 68% of the time. When women make the exact same pitch, research shows that it's actually only funded 32% of the time. And so these are the areas that we identify as the gender gap.
So what do you think what do you think the reason is there for why men pitching the very same idea would be successful while women would not?
That's a good question. I guess it's the perception. I guess that's what we're trying to find out in the research and to overcome that.
So you keep figures, I guess, on the number of female business owners in Cape Breton and related figures.
As the center is here, we will be
collecting
statistics. That is the goal, and we'll be sharing those as well. And I'm sure there'll be some good, there'll be some increase in some good statistics coming out.
So what about the services you offer to women in Cape Breton?
All right, so the services we have, we'll be offering business advisory, networking events, as well as we'll be delivering skills development and training programs. So these could be like 8-week certificate programs. We bring in someone from like law, like a lawyer, and they would discuss, you know, about sole proprietorship and incorporating and the basics for like the legal side of your business and what you're liable for, what happens in your business and when you go from, you know, partnerships as well. So different courses that are also certificates, which is very nice.
And how are these offered? Is there government funding behind it, or is it connected to university funding? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. So this program is funded by ACOA, the Atlantic Canadian Opportunities Agency, and the certificate programs that have been offered in the past in the HRM have been funded by the Labor and Advanced Education.
Okay, so you've got two levels of government funding there.
Yes.
One thing I'm wondering, why set up the center in Cape Breton now? I mean, one assumes that these services would have been valuable before. Why is the decision being made now to set it up here?
So in the past, Cape Breton businesses have been members of the center, and they've been serviced. They would travel to Halifax for their events and meetings, or they would be done over technology, so Skype and phone meetings. But now the center is coming to Cape Breton. They've been working on this for several years. And so the need is here, and the need is very vocal that they're looking for additional services. So, why we're here.
Are there going to be efforts made to network with local regional chamber of commerce to bring forward your group's concerns?
Yes, we'll be working closely with our the other organizations that work in economic development here in Cape Breton. We'll be working together to address these barriers and to make sure we complement each their programs as well. We're not here to duplicate anything that's currently existing. We're here to complement their program.
Okay. Now, before I let you go, just some general comments to some women out there who might be thinking of starting a business, but they have some uncertainties or some challenges. Any general advice that you would pass on?
I would say a lot of times when you're a small business, or any business, and especially if you're starting out or you're working another job and you're, you know, working the nights on your business, which is very common is when you start up, if you're growing your business, often you don't know where to go for help. You know you have questions or a problem, and you just don't know where to go. So I'd recommend reaching out to us here at the center or reaching out to one of the partners, and often we hear that, you know, there's so many partners out there, you don't know where to go. So reach out here to the center, give me a call. My number is 902-217-2660, and we'll refer you to who you should talk to and other partner organizations. We'll direct you. We'll also, you know, chat and assess, you know, where your needs are, and we'll have a chat We'll also refer you to the partners here in Cape Breton, and we'll do our best to ensure that you get the help you're looking for.
And where can people check out your organization online?
I think you can visit our website. It's the Center for Women in Business. So it's www.centerforwomeninbusiness.ca. So just my phone number, is 902-217-2660. You can call me at that number to make an appointment.
Thanks very much for your time, Courtney. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave.
This year marks the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion of Nazi-occupied France during the Second World War. On June 6, 1944, Canadian troops landed on a Normandy beach codenamed Juno. Four Cape Breton soldiers who landed on that day would soon become the victims of a war crime at the hands of SS troops. Craig Buckland from New Waterford has researched their story. Dialogue's Bobby Knock spoke with him.
I want to start off with a bit of an aside, because I know when people hear us talking about this and the 75th anniversary of D-Day, they're going to be saying, well, what about the Cape Breton Highlanders? But, of course, the Cape Breton Highlanders fought in Italy. And on D-Day, they had already been in Italy since November of 1943. Yeah. So the Cape Breton Highlanders weren't at D-Day.
No, they weren't. And it's funny, when I was doing my research with local veterans, that was one of two former who have now passed on, Jake Ryan and Sharky McDonald, Bob, that, the D-Day people get a lot of the, I wouldn't say fame, but they are recognized and everybody talks about it, whereas you just mentioned that, you know, 2 years previous to that, in 42 and thereabouts, the Highlanders were in Italy and forcing the Germans out slowly but surely and taking heavy losses over there as well. But they were quick to point out that, hey, we also played an important role there.
Yeah, they really were overshadowed by D-Day. I mean, Rome fell around the same time, and unfortunately, because the opening of the Second Front there in Normandy was such a big deal, they were overshadowed by that. So we're talking about today four Cape Bretoners who were members of the North Nova Scotian Highlanders or the North Novies, as they're called for short. And there were quite a few Cape Bretoners with the North Novies, I do believe. I think I know some veterans from Waikagama who were with the North Novies.
Yes, you could be from, I think, in fact, there may have been people that, soldiers from Ontario or other province as well, who ended up in the North Novas. It wasn't, if I'm not mistaken, certainly many, for the most part, they were from Nova Scotia. It's one thing that, as you're talking about D-Day, just that it was surprisingly that I read that the North Novas actually didn't storm the beach on D-Day. They were part of the second wave.
That's right.
Backup that waiting and behind for orders or to see what areas needed support or secondary support. They actually came ashore without a lot of incident or without heavy losses, like, you know, obviously Juno be there, but the North Novas. And I think that was maybe what, you know, on the other side, things went well in the beginning, but then quickly changed, as so often does at the time.
Yeah, so they came in, landed later, and made their way inland, and I guess begins with these four Cape Bretoners. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, I think, because of the fact, June 6th, everything was going well into June 7th, and they were advancing, but a couple of different things going on at the time. Certainly, the SS division that was around the area, among others, they were, at a distinct advantage because they knew the area so well. They had been living there and installed their defenses there for some time, so they had a clear view of the way the landscaping was there. They could see for miles that the Allied forces were approaching, and I think for the most part they let them advance as much as they wanted, and probably picked their spots for a few minor attacks towards the Canadians. But I think as they advanced, I think even the Canadians, they knew this is going a little bit too easy for us. Like, we're just, they knew the Germans were probably watching and that they were somewhere along the line, but they just couldn't tell where. And as they advanced, well, there was they had taken some casualties, but nothing serious. And then there was a couple things going on. I think as any attacking force would do, they would send out platoons or parties of scouting groups that would, they were looking to see what was out there. And I guess at that time, because a lot of the tanks were knocked out of commission, one of the things the Germans liked to do was go out at night and actually take back those tanks and repair them and get them back into service. And they were very good at that. And at the same time, from what I read, they were also looking for prisoners to interrogate and maybe get some information out find some information on maybe the size of the forces that were coming ashore and how, what exactly they could find out from a prisoner at that time. And, of course, the SS that were at the Abbey of Ardennes at that time, they were known as being, the baddest of the toughest sort of thing, German soldiers. They weren't your regular army. These guys were radicals, so to speak, and they were highly trained and very good at what they did.
And they were, I guess, Hitler fanatics as well. I guess they've been described. And this unit, they were young. They were teenagers, right?
Yeah, it was noted that there was a couple. There was actually a Polish soldier who had deserted the SS, and he provided the Canadians with some information, not only about the fact that, yes, that he was around when at least several of them were taken out back and executed. He heard the gunshots, and he knew at that time that that they were in fact executed. The powers that be at the time among the SS, Kurt Meyer at the time, he really asked. They kept capturing all these prisoners, and I think upwards of 150, 160 prisoners in all total. And eventually he said, why are you bringing me back so many prisoners, sort of thing. And in other words, it was the first of maybe encouraging his non-commissioned officers or his lower officers that, hey, no more prisoners. And the fact is, we're losing our soldiers. And I think it was insinuated that in not so many words that, no more prisoners, or let's do away with what we have.
And these guys, too, would have looked a little bit different from the regular German forces. I mean, they had camouflage smocks, and they, machine gun pistols, and they were better equipped than the regular forces. So,
and I think their leadership was well experienced in that type of warfare. And when you're installed and you've been there for a while, you can basically see who's coming at any time of the day. And let's not forget, there was a couple factors there. Not only that, but the Germans, of course, their artillery at the time was the famous 88. That was just part of it. The 88s were that accurate and that good that it was just a superior weapon at the time. And then, of course, we can go into, the tanks itself, whether it was the Sherman tank versus the German Panzers, or some of the superior armor that they had at the time, because really it was there was a difference. Certainly, even that time of the war, the German armor was definitely a step above ours.
Yes, yeah, and could easily penetrate the Sherman tanks that the Allies were using. So we're still June 7th here.
Yes,
the North Novies moving inland.
Yes.
Let's continue along the story here.
Just the fact, I think, as usual, they were moving ahead, and there was at least one group that was captured in and around June 7th, and they're not really sure if they went out looking for their own prisoners, whether they were trying to scout the area. But in any case, a group of them were captured at that time and taken back to the Abbey, or the Abbey Ardennes, which was basically a monastery, a medieval type of older church, almost like, with farm home houses and lots of gardens and chickens and cows and stuff like that. So it was a step back in time, really, the building itself. So the Germans were watching, and they were able to capture without too much effort. Also, on at least on two different times, platoons were encircled in and around Authie, mm-hmm. And once they would be encircled or trapped, then word would go out, and then other Allied platoons or companies would try to rescue them or try to relieve them, and that's where the Germans were really good at counterattacking. Once they saw that, you know, maybe they would put the bait out, sort of thing, that, okay, these guys are in trouble, we know the cavalry's coming, and when the cavalry comes, we're going to take on the cavalry, sort of thing. And I think that's what the Germans were really good at, just kind of counterattacking or waiting and hiding in the area, and then just ambushing. Again, so many Canadians had gone into it, the town on the outskirts of the abbey, and just were overwhelmed by German forces at the time. So many of them were, anytime they were surrounded like that, some of the wounded and whatnot, and were taken back to the abbey. So it wasn't just a soldier in good health who decided, all was lost to go back. It is recorded that some of the prisoners that were taken were also wounded soldiers. And in fact, from what I gather, some of those were also part of the 18 that were executed later on. So they were taken in, they were executed, they were, I guess Kurt Meyer at the time, he just decided he didn't have the time or patience to for all these prisoners. And once the word went out that some of them were going to be executed, I think one of the most touching things I read was that some of the prisoners who were lined up, and once they knew their fate, almost in defiance, they one by one they were being marched to the back courtyard and being shot in the back of the head or clubbed. That they actually exchanged pleasantries and shook hands and had a one last laugh or hug or whatever with their buddies before they were taken out back, even though they knew that the end was near. They still kept their chin up, sort of thing, and said, well, boys, we'll see you in a better life, sort of thing. And that was pretty sad to hear that.
Yes. And through your research, you discovered that the four Cape Bretoners who were among the North Novis, yes, who were taken prisoner were executed. And one of them was from your home community of New Waterford, Reginald Keeping.
He was a son of Wilson and Maud Keeping, and he was born in Burgio, Newfoundland, which happened to be the same town my grandfather was raised in, yeah, and lived in before he came to Sydney to work in the steel plant. Also, Joseph Francis McIntyre, age 28 at the time, son of Daniel and Florence, from Sydney Mine. Charles Doucette, who was 31, which would have been older than most of the soldiers at the time, for sure. Son of Mr. and Mrs. Peter Doucette, Mi'kmaq First Nation member too.
And we also had George Richard McNaughton from Sydney.
20, very much close to home. And as you said, Bob, that earlier on, most of the names that I have, and whether you call it 18 soldiers or 20, because some were killed, at that time, some were killed the next day, and yet others, it's recorded, may have been executed a week or two later.
So there's a plaque at the Abbey with how many names on it?
I believe 18.
18.
18, I believe, and it is a bronze plaque erected by the French family. And what was amazing, Bob, is that we went there, as one of many tour groups, but it was, again, to see so many Canadian, little mini Canadian flags along the bottom, and even flowers, and, a little, maybe a painted rock with a Canadian flag on it saying, Je me souviens, I will remember. Wow. You see those sort of things. You're like, wow, people have come from far and abroad, and they have remembered. So that not only the French family who responsible for putting up the plaque, but many, many others have come by to, to pay their respect to these fallen soldiers.
As you mentioned, you had a chance to visit, and you also heard from a member of the Vico family.
Yes. Yes. Jacques Vico was there, and he gave us he is quite a storyteller. He remembers, he was a boy at the time, but he remembers it vividly. And I think what happened was it was actually afterwards. It wasn't at the same time. Obviously, the Germans were in control of the Abbey at the time, and some of the Vico family were moved out. At least one or more had been captured by the Gestapo, as being part of the underground. And so, the Germans, they just at the time. Naturally, they went in, they just took over and did what they had to do to the place. And they were, they were living there for some time, had done at, after, into 45, and it was actually after 45 that the Vico family had noticed some irregularities in the garden growing out back. And the Mrs. Vico wondered, what's going on there? Had the Germans done something? And they took a shovel and just by chance dug it up. And lo and behold, they found several bodies there at the time. And then as they went around, they continued to find more bodies. So it wasn't like they found 18 bodies at the same place. It was like five here and four there or whatever. And then eventually, of course, we're talking 45 and then after the war. Well, it's a little bit vague as to exactly how many they found in one place, but the facts remain that, they were executed at the time. You can imagine that once word got out to the Canadian forces that, they were pretty upset with this. And,
yes.
And, there's a question as to whether, there was any revenge taken later in the year or whatever towards German soldiers. I'm sure, I wouldn't be surprised as a soldier if you saw some of your best buddies or heard that they were executed cold blood. Revenge would perhaps be on your mind, as other things.
Yes, exactly. Kurt Meyer himself, he ended up being arrested and court-martialed and being found responsible for allowing these executions to take place.
Yes, and he was decorated. Let's just touch on for a second there. As commander of the 25th Panzer Grenadier and 12th Panzer Division, a regiment of the 12th Panzer Division. He had won the Iron Cross, second class, and first class would be our equivalent of the Victoria Cross. Also the German Cross. So he really was one of their better leaders at the time, for sure. And in 45, he was actually brought to trial, and he denied any knowledge of the specific events in question. That being said, he was found guilty and sentenced to death originally. But then, as so often the case, things changed after that with regards to his sentence. General Chris Vokes, who was the responsible Canadian officer, said he really didn't deserve the death penalty, and that was our Canadian representative at the time who was dealing with this. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I believe life meant 20 years. So the first part of the sentence, Dorchester Penitentiary, and I believe it was commuted to 14 years, and then with good behavior, Meyer served somewhere around 8 or 9 years. There's an interesting story there, Bob. It's apparently there was other SS members at Dorchester who had served, who were imprisoned at the time, and they were around. And some of his former SS soldiers actually developed a plan to free him from Dorchester. They really thought they could break him out because Kurt Meyer had a routine every day, and the same two guards, and they would allow him to exercise and to run because Kurt Meyer was a bit of a fitness buff, and over a period of time, you see routines, and they firmly believed that they could bust him out of Dorchester and get him out of there. Now, where you would go in New Brunswick, I'm not sure, but it's said that Kurt Meyer said, I'm okay here, sort of thing. So he ended up doing about 8 years, but then he actually, when he did his time, he went back to the Abbey in person and spoke to the Vico family again. So imagine that after he had gone the trial, served his time, and then ended up back in France and went back to the Abbey for a visit in the late 50s. And Jean-Marie Vico, again, who was a lady there at the time, she said basically, why did you lie, sort of thing? And he said the obvious answer. He said, it's difficult for an officer to admit to an enemy court that such things had been done. He said, I lied at the time, but...
So he admitted responsibility out of court.
Yeah, and anybody under him would have said, hey, soldier takes orders and does what he's told, sort of thing. And that's what his, commission officers or whatever, and that's who he tended to blame. He said, it was a non-commissioned officer who did something, and I banished him to an outpost immediately following that, and he was killed. Now, we don't know a way of confirming that, of course, but And I suppose if we can give them a little bit of credibility in that, you know, the obvious way out sort of thing, in that, you know, one of my rogue officers or non-commissioned officers decided to do this, and I may or may not have known about it sort of thing. But the fact he went back to the Abbey, I thought, was pretty interesting, like a lot of nerve, basically, to go back there, and where, you know, the Vico family knew what had happened, because the Canadians had sent representatives from the government over there to continue some of the grave digging and determining, you know, because, you know, before the days of DNA, it was a little bit harder to determine, you know, based on remains in a grave, you know, who exactly the person was. Were they Canadian? Yes. Were they with the Novas, or were they from a different regiment or army at the time?
I was going to say, there's another irony with Meyer, because I've read accounts where he ended up going back to Germany and selling beer to Canadians who were stationed in Germany after the war.
Yeah, that's that is amazing. Like I'd heard that he became, you know, somewhat prosperous, although he died in 1961. He certainly had a charmed life, and he was able to do whatever the heck he wanted, even after the war. You know, despite being a convicted war criminal, you know, you would actually, you know, go into the middle of a known city and consider yourself an entrepreneur of sorts. Kurt Meyer just seemed to be, he had that attitude and probably a certain presence about him that people respected him, and he had enough connections, certainly direct and indirect, that you know, people didn't like to challenge him. It's almost like once he was a decorated veteran, he was able to basically come and go as he pleased.
And I guess finally, to remember the soldiers who were executed, at least under his command, whether he knew about it or not, or whatever the story may be, one of those soldiers, Charles Doucette, is the Canadian soldier whose gravesite is going to be honored in ceremonies to mark the 75th anniversary of D-Day. So I think that's a fitting tribute, given the circumstances under which he died. Anyway, I think it is fitting that it's Charles Doucette's grave that's going to be, that's the Canadian representative.
And the fact, you know, I think, you know, many of us tend to forget, you know, the contributions of First Nation soldiers at the time, and whether it was the Second World War or, of course, Korea. So many served, and, you know, without the fanfare and the glory, often the Mi'kmaq, such as Charles Doucette, must have had his own personal reasons for deciding to enroll and answer the call of his country. And, you know, for these guys, these four or these 18, you have to realize the war only lasted 2 days. Although they had trained long before, many of them, it was their first kick at the can sort of thing, or the first shot at the Germans at the time. So, you know, we have to respect that and certainly remember. So I think it's great that, you know, Charles Doucette and his family are being honored at this time, or remembered at least.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.